Greetings, everybody, and welcome back to Torah in Motion. The songs we sing, a study of Pirkei Tehillim, and I have to admit to a bit of human frailty. Not exactly, but last week at the end of the session, I announced that we'd be studying Perek Kuf Mem Chet, Psalm 148, which is the next in the series of Psukei Dezimra. But inspired as I was by the rest of the week of Chanukah, and noting that not only is the proper psalm of the day of Chanukah, and I'll share more of that as soon as we're able to get the source material up, Psalm 30, Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit David, but it's also something that is said traditionally every day in davening, and is not really part of Psukei Dezimra, but part of the introduction. And as such, I thought it would be most appropriate here for those of us who still want to hang on to a little bit of the Chanukah spirit, and for our brethren and sisters in the East who are still digging out from under all that snow, maybe a little bit of light and heat from Chanukah will remain. And in that honor, I've got the fire going behind me, and we will study together Psalm 30, Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit David. A few questions, and those of you who would like to follow, you can open up either your Psalm in the Tanakh, Tehillim, to Perek Lamed, or your Sidurim. If you have either Nusach Ashkenaz or Sfarad, you will find it just before Baruch She'amar. And you can follow it in there with translation. It's certainly a good idea. And right away, as we look at the opening Pasuk, what we refer to as the superscription, or the Koteret, the title of this chapter, we note immediately several anomalies. Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit LeDavid. The first thing is that this is a song of dedication of the house LeDavid. Now, if we read LeDavid, and we discussed this several weeks ago in our introduction to Psalm 145, to what's commonly called Ashrei, if we read LeDavid as meaning written by David or commissioned by David, then we have a serious problem if we assume that the bayit mentioned in this pasuk is Beit HaMikdash. Because, of course, David was not around for Chanukat Beit HaMikdash. So David could not have written a song in honor of that event, because the one great wish that David had, look at Samuel 2, chapter 7, was to build the Mikdash, and, of course, he was denied that request. Something that if this were a year-long session in the month of Elul, we would take a look at in Psalm 27, Achat Sha'alti. So there are several ways to understand this, and what some of the Rishonim have suggested, the Radak notably says that Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit was not in reference to the Beit HaMikdash, but to David's own palace, built for him by Hiram, the king of Tzor, a beautiful palace, which of course Eilat Mezar maintains. She has recently unearthed the foundations of in Ir David. And as such, Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit LeDavid would then be a song that David composed in honor of the dedication of his own palace. That's possible, but we have two other problems, one relatively minor, but not so, and one very obvious, and very much so, and that is in this opening pasuk. The opening pasuk itself has what seems to be a problem within it. Mizmor Shir, Chanukah Tabayit LeDavid. A mizmor is a song, and a shir is a song. And it's understood that Mizmor and Shir are so synonymous that the Midrash Tehillim that we may look at later on in this series in Mizmor Tzadi Bet 92, Mizmor Shir Liyom Shabbat, points out Kol Maaseh Shabbat Kfulim. Everything about Shabbat is doubled. Lechem Mishneh, Shnei Kvasim, you have two lambs, you have two loaves, you have Zachor V'Shamor, and you also have Mizmor Shir. In other words, the song of Shabbat is a doubled song, because Mizmor and Shir effectively mean the same thing. They indeed don't exactly, and Ibn Ezra points out that the word Mizmor comes from the punctuation or the parsing of a song, because we are Mizamer, we cut it, prune it, as it were. But, nonetheless, in colloquially, they're understood as the same thing. So Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit LeDavid carries with it a redundant term. But again, that's something that we could get around and might see it as some sort of an oratorial flourish if we wanted. But there's a far greater problem when we look at this, at the text itself, and that is that Mizmor Shir, doesn't look so great. All right, well, that's good. Let's keep it here. All right, excellent.
You did it already.
Everything looked good except the opening page. Go back to slide number 2 and we're good. Skip that one. Great. Thank you, Shalom. Shalom, everybody, please. Shalom Eisenstadt, our tech expert. Thank you. We'll take a look at this, at the passage in this piece from Masechet Sofrim in a moment. But when you read through Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tavayit David, and it's one of the things which, for many of us, is a great challenge, is things that we say every day, we don't necessarily pay a whole lot of attention to. And we assume their existence, and we assume the rectitude of the statement, so it's such that we don't stop to reflect, is this really what's being said, or is what being said make a lot of sense? We say Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tavayit David, which means we would then expect a psalm in the next 12 verses to be about building a house, or dedicating a house, or ideally, the Beit HaMikdash. And instead, what do we find? We seem to find, and we'll take a look at it in a few moments, a song sung by an individual who had a near-death experience, evidently from disease, was saved, and has come to thank God for his personal salvation. Meaning, he was near death, God saved him, he comes to the Mikdash, and we would assume with a Korban Todah, with a Thanksgiving offering, and now tells his story. It's all in the singular. It's not about anything about a house. It's not anything about building. It's about saving his life. So the larger question we have to ask is, what does Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tavayit David have to do with Aromimcha and the rest of the song? Just to finish the preface and to again explain why I've chosen to do this today, is that the light and the glow of the beautiful festival of Chanukah still remain for some of us, certainly in our hearts, and memories of beautiful evenings spent with family and friends, and singing, and all of the great celebration, and of course way too much food. And as such, I reflected over the course of the week about the fact that the custom in our synagogue and in many places is to recite this psalm every day of Chanukah. Indeed, in some places, the minhag is even to recite it after Mariv at night, and therefore I thought it would behoove us this great opportunity to study not only Pirkei Tehillim, but those Pirkei Tehillim that are part of davening, for us to study this parak today together, even though we missed Chanukah perhaps by a couple of days. But it's good prep for next year in any case. The source for the recitation of this psalm begins here, although it really doesn't begin here. And we will see that this psalm was recited by, or we could see this in the Mishnah and Bikurim, was recited in Second Temple times by the people who would come up to Yerushalayim with their Bikurim during the summer, and when they would come into the Azara with their baskets, the Levim would begin singing this song. This song also, we find out from the Sugya in Masachet Shavuot, was used any time there was a ceremony of broadening the walls or the borders of Yerushalayim, a Korban Todah, and Shir, and the Shir was this song, Aromimcha Hashem Kiditani. So clearly, the song, even though it includes nothing about the Mikdash itself, was understood in Bayit Sheni times to be somehow related to the Beit HaMikdash, which furthers, of course, our curiosity and the obligation for us to investigate and understand how that's so. First, I'd like to show this. Many of you are familiar, I'm sure, with the Mishnah in Masachet Tamid, Perek Zayin Mishnah Dalad, which lists those psalms that are said on a weekly basis each day of the week. Hashir Shalvim, Ayom Beit Hamikdash, and Bayom Rishon, they would say, Hashem Aratzum Loa, etc. And the final one is, V'Shabbat Ayomrim, Mizmor Shir Liyom HaShabbat, Mizmor Shir Latid Lavo Liyom Shkulo Shabbatum, Mechal Chayei HaOlamim. This is the reflection in the Mishnah. And according to that Mishnah, each day of the week, no matter what else was happening on that day, the Korban Tamid, the Tamid Shel Shachar of that day, was accompanied with that particular song. However, there are numerous braitot that show up in the Bavli and passages in Yerushalmi that indicate that on particular special occasions, there were other psalms that were either added to the accompaniment of the Korban, or substituted for the regular one, such as the Sugya in Sukkah that talks about which psalms were said on each day of Sukkot, Shir HaLamayim, etc., Chavtet. And the most famous is this passage in Masachet Sofrim, which is the 9th century compilation of much earlier liturgical practices from Eretz Yisrael, though the compilation was done in Bavel. And in Masachet Sofrim, chapter 18, we find the following passage. L'fichach nagu ha'am lomar mizmorim ba'onatan. Therefore, the nation has the custom to sing psalms at the proper time. And then it quotes the Mishnah that I just mentioned. And then the first piece of deviation from that Mishnah, or addition to the Mishnah, is B'chanukah aromimcha Hashem. It goes on the list. On Rosh Hashanah we say this, Yom Kippur we say Barchi Nafshi, and Mimamakim, and on Sukkot, etc. Indeed, the minhag of many people is to say both the regular psalm and the additional psalm. For instance, a nearly universal custom is that on Rosh Chodesh, to say the psalm of the day followed by Kuf Dalet, Barchi Nafshi. And indeed, in many places, on Rosh Chodesh Tevet, this past Thursday and Friday, we said the regular psalm, followed by Barchi Nafshi, followed by Mizmor Shir, and it gave a chance to teach the principle of Tadir Rishayno Tadir, that which is more frequent comes first. All very nice. The approach taken by the Gaon Vilna is that you only say one psalm a day. His position was that in the Mikdash, the Levim only had one song a day, and as such, we do not add Aramim Hashem. The minhag of many people, including in our family, is that on Chanukah, if it's not Rosh Chodesh or Shabbat, we only say Aramim Hashem. Nonetheless, what is clear is there is a fairly common, although not universal, minhag to recite this psalm as part of davening during Chanukah. And the connection with Chanukah and with the Beit HaMikdash is something, as I mentioned, is attested to even earlier in Tanaitic literature. But again, we have three problems. Problem number one is, what bayit are we talking about? If it's the Beit HaMikdash, then it's hard to believe that David composed it, unless, of course, unless we understand Lid David at the end of the opening line to refer to in honor of David or in memory of David, or alternatively to say that David composed it in anticipation, just as we read in Divrei Hamim Aleph Perek Vav, that David already set up the singers and the different groups of Levim in anticipation of the building of the Mikdash. However, there may be another way yet to go. The second problem we mentioned is the Mizmor and Shir seem to be doubled, and of course the largest problem is that no matter how we explain the opening line, there is nothing in the rest of the psalm that has anything to do, apparently, with building a Mikdash. So let's study the Perek together. Here we have it. I did not leave all 13 lines or 12 lines of the psalm itself, line after line, because then the print would be very small, and I will make this full screen so it will be a little bit bigger. Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit LeDavid. Aromimcha Adonai Ki Dilitani Velo Simachta Oyevayli. Adonai Elohai Shivati Elecha Vatirpaini. Adonai Helita Vin Sheol Nafshi Chitani Mior Divor. Zamru Adonai Chasidav Hodu Lezecher Kodesho Ki Rega Be'apo Chaim Birtzono Be'erev Yalim Bechi V'Laboker Rina. אמרתי בשלי בעלמות לעולם. אדוני בצורך עמדת להר ריוז, הסתרת פניך, הייתי נפעל. אליך אדוני קרב אל אדוני תחנן, מבצע בדמי בדורברתי השחת, הירך אפר, היגיד המתחה. שמע אדוני וחונני, אדוני היה עוזר לי, הפכת בסבידי למחול לי, בטחת עסקי ותעזרני שמחה, למען זמרך חבוד ולא ידום, אדוני אלוהי לעולם עודקה. I'm going to read it again. And I'm going to pause at certain points, because I believe that there is a shift in what is going on in the psalm. And this is a little bit of a coaching exercise, learning how to listen to a psalm or read a psalm, read a parak of Tehillim, and identify the different stanzas. Stanzas typically will shift, either by shift of voice, meaning an individual, and then suddenly it's a group singing, or a different individual, or by audience, who's being addressed, or by theme. Here we go. Here we have somebody who clearly is in a good position. He says, I will exalt you, Hashem, because you lifted me up. So as he was down, and Hashem lifted him up. We'll see what that kind of down is. Not only did you lift me up, but you did not allow my enemies to rejoice over me. Meaning that when I was down, there was the threat that my enemies would rejoice over my downfall. You lifted me up and didn't allow that to happen. Notice the beautiful language, I will exalt you, the Rame means really to lift God up, because you lifted me up. Now, Adonai Elohai, Shivati Elecha, Vatirpaini. Now we find out what what being down meant. Militarily, politically, financially, we find out that it means health-wise. Hashem, my God, I begged you, I cried out to you, and you healed me. We find out, Adonai he'alita min she'ol nafshi, you lifted my life up from she'ol, from the grave, meaning he was almost dead. Chitani mi'or divor, you gave me life rather than allow me to fall into the pit. And there are many who point out that Chanukah always comes around the time that we read the story of Yosef, and the allusions here of Yaakov going to she'ol, and Yosef being thrown in the pit, and a little later on, another allusion to Yosef. Very interesting. Now, up until this point, the singer has been speaking to God, thanking God for what God has done for him. There is a shift now. Zamru l'Adonai chasidav v'hodu l'zecher kodesho. What's the shift? He now turns not to God, but he turns to an audience. And the audience, as we saw in Kuf Mem Hei, chasidav, means the loyal followers of God. So, sing to Hashem, you followers of God, v'hodu l'zecher kodesho, and give thanks to the memory of His holiness. Give thanks to His holiness. Why? Ki rega biapo chayim bertzono. And rega biapo means even though there is a moment of anger, nonetheless, chayim bertzono. Ratzon, as the older Tanakh meaning, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, meaning favor or grace. When God is angry, that's only a moment. But being in His grace is for eternity. What does that mean? That means, Ba'erev yalin bechi v'labokerina, quoting Annie, the sun will come up tomorrow. Meaning, you go to bed and go to sleep weeping, in the morning you wake up singing. In other words, things could be bad, but that bad is momentary. It is illusory almost. It is fleeting. And the good, the being in God's graces, having good life, that's forever. So you could go to bed at night feeling very sad, wake up, but suddenly everything is okay. I don't know whether the musical posers for Annie took their cue of the song from here, but it's a perfect fit. Now, at this point, he has been first thanking God and then turning to his audience and suggesting to them why they should join him. And now, Vani Amarti Vishalvi seems to be neither speaking to God nor speaking to his audience. He seems to be speaking to himself. Important to note about the word Amar. Whenever you have the word Amar in Tanakh, I'm going to go back here so I can see some of you. Whenever you have the word Amar in Tanakh, as you have here, normally there is some sort of an audience to whom, by Yomer Hashem El Moshe. Right, but whenever you have Amar, usually in the first person, without a target, what it means is thought or decided. For instance, in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Bet, the Ish Elokim comes to Eli and says, Amor Amarti, Atar Beit Avicha Yitachu Lefanai Olam. That I said, God said, you, Eli, and your family will be my Kohanim forever. Meaning, this is what my intention was, my thought was. Instead, I'm removing you, etc. Read the story there. So here, Vani Amarti, without an audience, means this is what I thought. And now this is the singer speaking. Vani Amarti Bishalvi. I said when things were relaxed or serene, Bal Emot Leolam. I will never crumble. I will never fall. There's an interesting use of the word here. Bal Emot Leolam means I will never fall, but the verb Lehit Motet is one that is never used in the context of people, but rather buildings or mountains. As an example, in Yeshayahu, Ki harim yamushu v'hagavaot timutena, the hillocks will crumble. So that's an interesting twist. But that means the person felt he was like a strong house, he was like a powerful mountain, and a strong mountain, and he would never fall. This line, easiest to illustrate via nearly annual tragedy that we especially those of us who work education, nearly always, sometime in the spring, in May or June, you hear a story about a pickup truck or a van that has 14 high school kids coming back from their prom, a bunch of kids sitting in the back, nobody's got seat belts, and the driver's going 90 miles an hour and goes off the road and kids are killed. It's always a terrible tragedy, and unfortunately it's something that we do hear about pretty much on an annual basis, hopefully only once. And the reason for that is because there is a particular age at which people feel, I'm going to live forever. Nothing can stop me. Nothing can kill me. I'm invulnerable. And as a result, people often make extremely foolish mistakes. But that's what is being described here. Ani amarti b'shalvi, when things were comfortable, when things were serene, I said, I would live forever. Olam le'olam, I'll never crumble. So what happened? Adonai b'tzoncha, again, ratzon here meaning grace, hamadta laharami oz, you stood me up as a strong mountain. And again, notice the imagery here of a house on a mountain, not of a person. Istarta fanecha hiti nivhal. You turned your face away and I was confused. I was shocked. I was scared. In other words, there was a realization, and now with hindsight a realization, that when everything was good and I was comfortable and serene and felt invulnerable and felt I would live forever, I felt like an immortal almost, or perhaps not almost, I now realize that was because I was in your favor. And then you turned away from me, which learned earlier, is for a moment, and suddenly everything fell apart. And we all can understand what that's like, to have everything going along swimmingly, and then there's a phone call, and there's a report from a doctor, and there's some bad news, or there's a rumor of bad news, and suddenly our whole world turns upside down. Everything's shaken up. Everything that we thought we could rely on, we can't rely on anymore. And, of course, everybody experiences that in different ways, but the experience itself is a common one. Now, what does the singer continue to say? Elecha Adonai Akrav, El Adonai Tchanan. I call out to you, Hashem, and I petition before my Lord. But this is a little strange, because by this point in the narrative, or this point in the story, the person has been healed, has been saved, and why is he crying out to God? And he then turns and says, Ma Betza, and that's another allusion to the Yosef, right? Ma Betza Bidami. Now, this is certainly, in rabbinic language, a very beautiful allusion, because bidami, tamim in rabbinic Hebrew, means money. Of course, tamim in biblical Hebrew means one of two things, either blood, but in this case it means silence. Ma betza bidami. What value, what benefit will there be in my silence, b'riti el shachat, if I go to the underworld, meaning if I die? Hayodecha afar, hayidamitacha? Will the dirt thank you? Will the dirt speak of your truth? So in other words, he's presenting an argument why God shouldn't kill him. But this is very strange because, or shouldn't allow him to die. This is very strange because, of course, he's already okay. He's already better. We assume that he's in the Mikdash because he's giving a song of thanksgiving along with a thanksgiving offering for getting better. And he concludes it by saying, Shema Adonai v'choneni. Hear me, Hashem. Have grace on me. Adonai hayyehu simli. Be my helper. Very strange. Kind of hard to figure out what's going on in this mizmor. And of course, the larger question that looms over all of this is, what does this have to do with the Beit HaMikdash? The mizmor concludes, Hafachta mispedi l'macholi. Again, it's important to note the difference between biblical Hebrew and rabbinic Hebrew, what we call Ivrit Mikra'it and Ivrit Chazalit. In rabbinic Hebrew, the word misped means a eulogy. It's something that sometimes mourners, sometimes others offer at the occasion either of the burial or a memorial time for someone who's passed on. But mispeid in Tanakh doesn't mean that. Mispeid in Tanakh means mourning. So therefore you have eight lishchot ve eight lisfod in Kohelet, a time to weep and a time of mourning. That's a time of to laugh and a time to weep, to mourn. Bahvachta mispedi l'macholi, you turned my mourning into a dance. And this seems to go back to the earlier part. So you go to sleep crying, you wake up smiling, you wake up singing. But then again, the whole middle part of this chapter seems very strange. Itachta saki v'tazreni simcha. And this is a wonderful imagery. Itachta saki, you took my sackcloth and you undid it, you loosened it. That sackcloth I was wearing because I was in mourning. V'tazreni simcha, you girded me. So instead of my sackcloth, you girded me with happiness. Not with a garment, but with happiness. Then we conclude with Leman Yizamecha Chavod Velo Yidom, so that Chavod, and we'll have to see what that means, will sing to you and not be silent. Adonai Elohai Leolam Odecha, I will thank you forever. Truth is that even besides the problems of the opening line of Yizor Sheikh Hanukkah Tavayt David, this psalm is riddled with difficulties. The words are all understandable, except for one that I'll get to right away. But otherwise, we know what the words mean. But the sense of this is difficult. The timing of this is difficult. The context is difficult. What is it that's going on? I want to just quickly address the one difficult word here, the word kavod, l'man zarech kavod, which many of the Rishonim understand as being actually kaved, my liver, meaning my insides. My insides will sing to you and never be silent, and I will always thank you. Okay. But again, we have a great difficulty here in putting together what this whole psalm is about. And that's why we have to look at the stanzas. So again, we start at the beginning, and let's see if I'm successful in playing with the whiteboard here. Okay, we're going to do a little highlighting. Let's see if this works. Somebody could please buzz me, send me a text message, and let me know if this works. We start here. We have the opening line. I'm going to change the color on that. This. Okay. There we go. And we continue here. He continues to say that. And let's try it again. All the way through here, we have this whole section. He's describing what happened. Adonai elita mishol nafshi chitani mior divor. All right, so this whole piece. You lifted me up from death, you gave me life, and now there is a shift. And indeed, let's see if this will work here. Well, good. Actually, we're going to change that color later. All right. The Rula Adonai Chatzidevo Luzecha Kocho, he is now speaking to those who are around him. And what is he telling them? Ki rega biapo. Notice he's talking to God in the third person. Ki rega biapo chayim b'tzono ba'elim b'chi b'okarina. Meaning, you should all give thanks to God because you should understand that sometimes there'll be a moment of pain, a moment of difficulty, but in the morning you wake up and everything is fine. Now notice that something dramatic has changed. Bani amarti v'shalvi is his own self-reflection. This is what I thought. I thought that I would live forever. You stood me up like a strong mountain, you turned away from me, and suddenly I was in shock. And at this point, we get his tefillah. Let's see what is going on here with his tefillah. That's his tefillah. Then, and finally, we hear him thank God as if he's in present time, and saying, you have turned my sadness into dancing, you've taken off my sackcloth, etc. And so now we have a whole different piece. Let's look at what we got here, and now just to complete the picture, I'll go back and put that fellow on top of the current song that he's singing. And somebody might want to even take a screenshot of this. And you can see that this is really made up of five different parts. First part is his declaration of thanksgiving, and then he turns to the audience and tells them to join him. That's number two. Number three in the purple is when he describes what happened to him. And then number four is this tefillah in the blue, and then in the pink you have his current thanksgiving for where he's at. Strange, hard to figure out what it is that's going on. So perhaps we'll get a clue if we can look ahead a little bit. In order to do that, we have to look at some texts that reflect and will help us understand Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayit David. First thing is a text in Sefer Dvarim. Sefer Dvarim, we hear about destruction. God will bring us to land. God will take care of us. We'll win out the wars, conquer the land, settle in, and then if at some point the nation follows other gods, whores after other gods, then we find this line, V'chara api vo v'yomahu v'azavtim, and then we have this line right here. Starti fanai mehem hayal le'echol tzor ha'or ba'od v'tzorot v'mav yomahu alo alo al ki'in alohai v'kim yosonero ta'ele. I know why this is happening to me, because God is not with me, Anochi haster astir panai bayom ahu. I will indeed hide my face from them. Akol ara asher asa. So we have this notion that we found in our Mizmor back here. Hishtarta fanacha iti nival. We have this notion in our not just in the psalm, but in our historic ascents of what destruction is about. Destruction is not about God getting angry with us, it's about God turning his face away. They reflect anger. But it's not active anger as much as it is that God turns away from us. Now let's see, we have two more sources to look at. And this one is probably the most critical one to understanding all of this. A little bit of background will be very helpful. In the end of the 7th century BCE, there was one prophet during the reign of Yoshiahu and later during the reign of the last few kings of Yehudah, who was a true and loyal prophet to Hashem and told everybody the things that Hashem prophesied, had given him as far as what was going to be happening, and that included that we would be subjugated to the Babylonians, etc. And he was the only prophet of the ones that we know of who was being loyal to the calling. And in the meantime, the puppet king of the Babylonians installed in 597 BCE, Mataniah, whose name was changed to Tzidkiyahu, had a court full of false prophets. And the false prophets were saying, God will never destroy his house, and God will not allow us to fall, and don't worry about it, and you can go to war against them. And of course, we all know the history that didn't play out that way. What does Yirmiyahu say? Chapter 7, Yirmiyahu was the one true Navi. Al tiftechu lachem al divrei hashekar limor. Don't pay attention, people, to these lies. What are the lies they're saying? Hechal Adonai, Hechal Adonai, Hechal Adonai Hema. Everybody's walking around saying, God's house, God's house. I'll never destroy God's house. The rest of that chapter is very powerful. He says, take a look and see what happened to Shiloh. They behaved badly, and I destroyed Shiloh, and I'll destroy this house also. Remember, there was no history of a Korban HaBayit. That's the first Beit HaMikdash. Nonetheless, Yirmiyahu is saying you should not have such a sense of security that God won't destroy his house. If the people behave in such a way to make them unworthy, then indeed they will lose that house. With that background in mind, I'd like to take us through a little bit of history. In the year 597, as I mentioned, 597 BCE, Babylonia came and conquered Yerushalayim, took Yehoiachin away, that's Galut Yehoniah or Yehoiachin, and installed a puppet king. Puppet king was told, be a good boy, don't give us any problems, and you will be able to maintain your kingdom, and everything will be fine. The Mikdash continued to operate, albeit under foreign rule. About 8 years later, he was given really bad advice, signed an agreement with the Egyptians against the Babylonians, and as a result of that, brought the wrath of the Babylonians. They set up, coming up very soon, they set up a siege around the city. That's on the 10th of Tevet, in less than a week. Ultimately, 2.5 years later, in the summer of 586 BCE, destroyed the Beit HaMikdash and the city and the palaces and everything else. That, of course, is recorded in Sefer Melachim and in Sefer Yirmiyahu and in Echa, and it's a very, very painful part of our history. In 539 BCE, an amalgamation of Persian and Median tribesmen, led by a fellow named Cyrus, overthrew the Babylonians. And in so doing, allowed anybody, including Am Yisrael, to go back, anybody who the Babylonians had conquered and enslaved and repatriated, to allow them to go back to their ancestral home, build their temples, reinstate their culture and their language, etc. And that included, of course, us, which is recorded at the end of Sefer Divrei Yamim at the beginning, in a parallel overlapping passage at the beginning of Sefer Ezra. The Jews returned, albeit in very pathetic small numbers, take a look at Ezra Perek Bet, and came back, and we spoke about this last time in the context of Kuf Mem Zayin, and the Mikdash was finally rebuilt in the year 515 BCE and dedicated on Gimel Adar of that year under the leadership of Haggai and Zechariah. But as you can read in Sefer Malachi, a good 50 years later, there was still a very pathetic, an apathetic and denigrating kind of attitude of the people towards their own mikdash. Part of the reason for that was that mikdash was under foreign rule, and their ability to build, bring korbanot, to celebrate, was subject to foreign intervention and foreign veto. As we saw regarding the 20 years between when they started rebuilding the mikdash and when they were finally able to complete it, a suspension that was caused by the Persian government, just responding to the Shomronim and to their bad mouthing Bnei Israel. In any case, that was the situation for hundreds of years. The mikdash was not related to in such a powerful way. It wasn't seen as such a special place, and we lived under foreign rule until the year 164 BCE. 164 BCE, in the fall, there was the end of the culmination of 3 years, although it was not the end of the war, the culmination or the climax of 3 years of revolt of the Hasidim and the Hashmonaim, or the Hasidim who became the Hashmonaim, and finally successfully threw the Greeks out, reestablished the monarchy, but for our purposes, most critically, in 164, liberated the Beit HaMikdash, and within a couple of years, the Mikdash was now operating under Jewish rule for the first time since Yechoniah. As a result of that, the people who came in to rededicate the Mikdash felt, to a great extent, and it's recorded in the Book of Maccabees, felt to a great extent a sense of thanksgiving to God and a sense of hope and prayer that they would never again fall into the trap of what had happened earlier. Now, important to note, what was the trap they felt earlier? Look at this passage in Yirmiyahu, and you could see, and they were very likely aware of this, that the people living during the times of the first Mikdash took the Beit HaMikdash for granted. They felt it will never fall. Hashem will never destroy his house. There is a renewed awareness and vigor that happens here in which the people understand that we cannot take it for granted. We must always maintain our moral vigil and our moral station in order to maintain the sanctity that allows the Mikdash to stay within us. That's critical. Let's take a look now with all of that background at the psalm from another perspective. I'd like to suggest the psalm be understood as being made up of three stanzas. First stanza on the right and the last stanza on the left, and I'll go to full screen now to give some more space, should be seen as somewhat parallel. And in order to understand that, I'd like to suggest the following. Take a look at the title. I'd like to suggest that the original title of this Mizmor was Mizmor LeDavid. Mizmor LeDavid, a song of David. It was a song of David either composed by David at some point in his life when he was ill and near death and was restored, or it was composed by someone else, or it was composed by David on behalf of someone else, or on behalf of anybody who might come, who had had a near-death experience and now wanted to thank God. Perhaps David had composed it. What's critical here is that the psalm, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, is not about a Beit HaMikdash. It's about somebody being deathly ill and getting better. But what does the penitent say in this song? Notice, he begins by saying, and notice in this, on the right column, here, let's see if this will work. On the right column, I'm going to put a line here. Okay. On the right column, you have the colors we had. You have the description of God saving him from near death. And then he switches to this other sense in which he turns to the audience. And he says, there's a lesson in what just happened to me. That lesson is that things can look bad, but then they get better. And he tells them that they should all give thanks to God for that. And give thanks to God for the fact that pain right now, but tomorrow it's better. This last line, and I apologize for this last line here, really belongs up here in the next column. And read it that way. Bani amarti b'shalvi. important to note what the word amarti means. Amarti does not mean I said, it means I had said. It's past perfect, which means at this point there's a flashback in the narrative. In other words, picture as follows. There's a fellow who comes to the Beit HaMikdash because he was almost dead, and he was spared and saved, and he wants to thank God. He brings a Korban Todah. Korban Todah, typically, the person's going to get up and say why he's thanking God. This almost happened, he was saved, a great fortune came to him, he won the lottery, whatever it might be, he wants to thank God. So therefore, he gets up and tells a story, and then there's a flashback, and he says, this is what things were like when I was comfortable. Meaning, he's going to go back and tell the story of his fall. When I was comfortable, I thought I would live forever. You stood me up like a strong mountain. You turned away from me, and I was scared. Now notice, this is an individual talking about his own sickness. However, the terms he uses, bal emot, hari oz, are terms that relate to houses and mountains, not to people. But for whatever reason, that's what he chose to use in his song, that he was like a strong mountain and a strong house. He starts a fanecha, you turn your face away, which is something used throughout Tehillim about the personal relationship between God and man, is also something that evokes a memory from Sefer Dvarim, the first source we looked at, Haster Astir Fanai Banei Omarhu, about the national exile being the result of God turning his face away from us. Now, the key pasuk we want to take a look at is right here. Elecha Adonai Ekrav El Adonai Etchanan. What does this mean? Right here. This is not part of his narrative. This is part of his flashback. In other words, he said, this is what I felt. Suddenly you turned away from me and I was scared. And this is what I did. I turned to you, Ekra now here being in the past tense. I called to you. And I begged to you. And what did I say? I said, a typical argument that we find throughout Tanakh, not save me because I'm worthy or save me because of chesed, but save me because it will do damage to your great name if I'm gone. Moshe Rabbeinu turns to Hashem and says, you can't destroy Bnei Israel because what are people going to say? You took them out of Mitzrayim to kill them in the desert. What will happen to the Brit with Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov? You can't do it because of your name. Here he uses a similar argument and says, if I die, what's the gain to you? Who's going to thank you? Who is going to sing your praises? That's the point that he's making. Now, Shema Adonai V'chaneni, Adonai Yehozoli, is the end of his prayer. Meaning, Elecha, this entire section, right here, this entire section is his tefillah from then. Elecha Adonai Kravi Al Adonai Chanan. What was the tefillah? Mabetzav Dharmi V'yotir Shachad Adchai Fargenitacha. And he closes tefillah by saying, Shema Adonai V'chaneni, Adonai Yehozoli. That's what he said then. And now what does he do and turn around and say now, after he's recounted how he prayed then? He now turns around and says, "Hafachta bin tzbedil macholi p'tachta sakir atazreni simcha." In other words, you have turned my sadness, my mourning. I was in mourning here. You turned it into a dance. You took off my sackcloth and given me simcha. What's the upshot of this? This is the critical piece. What am I supposed to learn from this? That I will thank you forever. Well, how's that any different than the beginning? The answer is take a look, a very careful look at the beginning. The opening line here, he says the following. Armimcha Adonai ki dilitani. Right? In other words, I will thank you, because you have lifted me up. In other words, because you have lifted me up, when you lift me up, I thank you. Not always. When things are good, I thank you. Now he says, I thank you forever. I'm suddenly aware that everything I do, every moment that I have, every step I take, and every breath I take, is a bracha, is a great blessing, and I should not take any of it for granted. In other words, our friend here, who was sick, who was deathly ill, and got better, has now realized that his life is a great blessing, and he should not take any of it for granted. We've sort of moved from the teenager who goes 90 miles an hour with people in the back of the truck and no seatbelts, to somebody who's aware that every moment that he's around is a great blessing. Here's what I'd like to suggest. And it is in the form of a chidush, I'll admit. That the song was originally Mizmor LeDavid. Look at the top of the page. Mizmor LeDavid, and then the entire psalm. Armimcha Adonai Kiditani, etc. It was a song sung or composed by an individual, whether David or someone else in honor of David, or David for someone else, who had been near death, reflected on his mistaken orientation about his own place in life as being invulnerable and immortal, realized that was not the case, and then begged God to save him. And when God saved him, he said, I will take a lesson from that and commit to never again taking it for granted, but rather to thank you all of the time, at every moment, realizing that every moment of life is a great blessing. That's the song. And that song was around for maybe 500 years, 600 years, 700 years. And then, or maybe even 900 years, and in the year 164 BCE, or thereabouts, when the Hashmonaim came in and rededicated the Mikdash, a Mikdash that had been destroyed because the people had taken the Mikdash for granted, as we saw in Yirmiyahu Perek Zion, a Mikdash which they had lost when God turned his face away, a Mikdash which is both a mountain and a house that had both crumbled, at least metaphorically, if not actually, due to taking things for granted and due to their not being vigilant enough in their own moral station. And they added three simple words to this song that changed everything. The three simple words were this. Shir Chanukat HaBayit. In other words, instead of it being Mizmor LaDavid, it was Mizmor Shir Chanukat HaBayit. LaDavid. We don't take out the word LaDavid, we don't take out the word Mizmor. We keep the psalm as it is, but they added three words in. This is now a song of Chanukat HaBayit. In other words, this individual song of salvation and thanksgiving after being saved on a personal level now becomes our song of salvation on a national level. Therefore, this, even though the opening, and this, now we answer all the questions. Question number one, how could it be Mizmor Shir Chanukat HaBayit David? David is not in connection with the Bayit. Indeed, the song is not about the Bayit. The song is about somebody being sick. Why is it Mizmor Shir? Because they're from two different layers, two different time periods. It's Mizmor the David with Shir Chanukat HaBayit added in. And the third point is that what is the connection between the opening line and the rest of the psalm? There is none except via historic hindsight. Were the people who came in and dedicated the Mikdash and felt for the first time since the times of Yechoniah, this is a Mikdash under Jewish sovereignty. Or perhaps since the first time since Yoshiyahu, this is a Mikdash operating under proper Jewish sovereignty and loyal Jewish sovereignty. But now we're dedicating the house with a commitment that it will never again fall because we're committing not to take it for granted. We will never again take our teenage life for granted here in our older years, as it were. This now explains several things. This explains why the Levim, when they would take the fruit in the Mikdash, when the person would take the basket off, would sing Armim Hashem Kididitani. First of all, because the individual is also giving thanks for his life, for his fruit. The second thing is, this is a celebration of the Beit HaMikdash. And this is, of course, recorded from late Bayit Sheni times. We now understand why in Bayit Sheni times, when they expanded the city, they used this song. Because they were giving thanks for having gotten the city back, for being able to strengthen the walls under Nehemiah. And we, of course, understand why, as early as the 8th or 9th century, and perhaps earlier, this psalm was seen as associated with the festival of Chanukah, such that the custom became prevalent in many circles to add it on or substitute it as the Shir Shel Yom during Chanukah. Last note about this, and then I'll open up to questions, is that in the 16th century, this found its way into the Siddur. It's one of the last additions, as it were, to Siddur, although the Siddur continues to evolve, as it were, but it's one of the most recent additions, that this psalm came in, and I believe it was through the school of the Arizal, into the Tefillah before Psukei Dezimra, and part of the reason, of course, is because it reflects the same notion. Boker Ina, I wake up in the morning and I'm singing to you, God, I'm thanking you for every moment that I have, for everything that I have, and taking none of it for granted. Okay, I'm going to open it up to questions. If anybody would like to ask on mic, you could open your mic. If you want to ask on text, I'll take the chat. And if not, then we have about 3 minutes or so for something small in Parshat HaShavua. But I would much rather hear from you and see what's on your mind about this shiur. Okay, everybody, your mics are available, and I see a couple people who are coming on, so speak up. Okay, and I'm not hearing from anybody, so if you do have a question, please send it via the text. And I will make one other request. Anybody of our participants who has any suggestions that could make the shiur even better, there's a difficulty here. I'm used to speaking in front of people who are right there in the room. And so anything that you could suggest that would make it more interesting or easier to follow, please let me know, because this is a work in progress, as it is Torah in motion. In any case, we have Parshat Vayigash. Parshat Vayigash, of course, begins with Yehuda addressing Safnat Paneach, the regent of Egypt, and begging that he take Binyamin off of the slavery block, and not take him as a slave, and rather allow Yehuda to take his place. And the reason, of course, is that Yehuda became an arev, became a guarantor for Binyamin. After Yehuda's impassioned plea, Yosef, who twice earlier moved away from the brothers while still playing the charade of not knowing them, or not being a brother, and had moved away and wept, this time finally threw everybody out. In a sense, almost from the text, it is almost that he could hardly wait to get everybody out. It was just a rush job, get everybody out of the court. And then Yosef wept openly in front of them and said, "I am Yosef." Question I'd like to pose, I'm not going to answer it here. Question I'd like to pose, you have a whole week to think about it. Send me an email if you got some suggestions. And next week, I'll leave a little time at the end of the shiur to take your responses and to hear what you think. And we'll go from there. My question is, what was it about Yehuda's speech that convinced Yosef that at this time he should reveal himself? There are several possibilities. Possibility one, is there something in Yehuda's words that changed his mind? Possibility two is, there was nothing in Yehuda's words, meaning that Yosef was going to reveal himself at this point anyways, and this was just a good opportunity. If the second, then there's really nothing to look for in Yehuda's words. And then we have to ask the question, why did Yosef decide that this was the time to reveal himself as opposed to some other time? If, on the other hand, there is something in Yehuda's words, what is it? What did Yehuda say that convinced Yosef that he should reveal himself and indeed caused him to break out in sobbing and Ani Yosef, etc.? So let's hear what you have to think about. What you think about it? Send me an email off text. I will put my email up right here as in a chat note, and you can send it to me. There we go. And you can send me a note what you think about it. Share it with some friends. We'll do a little email Torah over the course of the week. We'll meet again in a week, and then we will go back to Tehillim Kuf Mem Chet. We'll probably cover Kuf Mem Chet and Kuf Mem Chet next week in the penultimate shiur. And then for the last shiur, I'm going to give an introduction to Kabbalat Shabbat, which of course includes many of the Pirkei Tehillim. I did get an answer here from Yisrael. It's an interesting suggestion. I hope you don't mind that I mentioned it online, but he suggests that perhaps Yosef was impressed by how Yehuda stood up to do the right thing and be courageous in the right way this time, as opposed to, as opposed to selling Yosef and doing other things that perhaps were not as courageous. Certainly possible. We'll take a look at it together next week. Everybody should have a wonderful week. See you next week, and do stay in touch.